This is Setting the Record Straight on BreadboxMedia.com. I'm Chuck Coughlin. You know what this podcast is about? It's smashing statues. The new iconoclast. That's our subject today. At the time of this podcast, all around the United States, statues are being taken down or toppled and broken, and some put away in storerooms or just moved. A lot of the statues honor Confederate heroes or a Confederate cause. Some honor people like Columbus or even George Washington. This is the new iconoclast. Why do I say new? New iconoclast? Because it's an old phenomenon. It's a destructive impulse that reemerges once in a while in human history. I'd like to take a minute to talk about the term iconoclasm and iconoclast. In a modern sense, somebody who speaks against an established order is an iconoclast. But it had a more specific sense in the 8th and 9th centuries. This was when the term iconoclasm was coined, derived from the Greek iconoclasmos, meaning image breaking. The iconoclasm is the name of the heresy that in the 8th and 9th centuries disturbed the peace of the Eastern Church, caused the last of the many breaches with Rome that prepared the way for the schism of Photius, and was echoed on a smaller scale in the Frankish kingdom of the West. The story in the Eastern Empire, the Byzantine Empire, is divided into two separate persecutions of the Catholics and resulted in the destruction of many objects of art that had sacred subjects. In the Byzantine Empire, there were two separate but very similar periods of image-breaking of iconoclasm, where history rhymes, because at the end of each persecution stands the figure of an image-venerating empress, two empresses, each one restoring the art objects with sacred subjects. The first persecution was ended by the Empress Irene, and the second by the Empress Theodora. So let's take a few moments to spend on the first persecution, the first iconoclasm, and the second iconoclasm. Historians have often seen iconoclasm as an effect of Muslim influence, because to Muslims, any kind of picture, statue, or representation of the human form is an abominable idol. It is true that, in a sense, the Khalifa at Damascus began the whole disturbance, and that the iconoclast emperors were warmly applauded and encouraged in their campaign by their rivals at Damascus. But on the other hand, it's not likely that the chief cause of the emperor's zeal against pictures was the example of his bitter enemy, the Muslims. A more probable origin will be found in opposition to the pictures that had existed for some time among Catholics. There seems to have been a dislike of holy pictures and a suspicion that their use was, or perhaps would become, idolatrous among certain gullible Catholics. That suspicion existed for many centuries before the iconoclast persecution began. There was a group called the Paulicians, as part of their heresy, held that all matter, especially a human body, is bad. This is not an unusual perversion of theology through history. The Gnostics hold to that belief also. And following that belief that the human body is bad, therefore all external religious forms, sacraments, rites, and especially material pictures and relics, should be abolished. To make it worse, to honor the cross was especially reprehensible. So this Byzantine iconoclasm was a contest between different wings of the Catholic Church. The Empress Irene, who was regent for her son Constantine VI, he was only 9 years old when his father died. She immediately set about undoing the work of the iconoclast emperors. Pictures and relics were restored to the churches. Monasteries were reopened. Fear of the army, now fanatically iconoclast, kept her for a time from repealing the laws. But she only waited for the opportunity to do so and to restore the broken communion with Rome and the other patriarchs. And what about the Patriarch of Constantinople, Paul IV, who had been in favor of iconoclasm? He resigned and retired to a monastery. 27 years later, iconoclasm broke out again. Again, the holy pictures were destroyed and their defenders fiercely persecuted. So, in the next 28 years, we went through this whole sequence in the story all over again, exactly the same. The places of Leo III and Constantine V are taken by a new line of emperors, iconoclasts, every one of them. St. John Damascene lives again in St. Theodore the Studite. Again, one synod rejects icons, and another one follows on, defending them. Again, an empress, regent for her young son, puts an end to the storm and restores the old custom. This time, finally restores it. Now, the origin of this second outbreak of iconoclasm is not hard to discover. There was a pretty good-sized iconoclast party remaining, especially in the army. The iconoclastic general Constantine V had won a lot of battles against the Muslims, very successful. But after him came Michael I, who was defeated by the Muslims. He was not doing a good job at defending the empire. The iconoclasts looked back regretfully to the glorious campaigns of his predecessor, and they evolved the amazing conception of Constantine as a saint. They went on a pilgrimage to his grave and cried out to him. They went to his grave and said, "Arise, come back, save the empire." An officer and a monk, it was Abbot John Grammaticus, persuaded the new emperor that all the misfortunes of the empire were a judgment of God on the idolatry of image worship. So Leo, once persuaded, used all his power to put down the icons, and all the trouble began again. And that was put down. The day of that victory became a feast day, the Triumph of Orthodoxy, it was called. The Triumph of Orthodoxy feast day, and the end of the long iconoclast persecution. It is still the Feast of Orthodoxy of the Byzantine Church. They still keep it very solemnly. 20 years later, the Great Schism began. So large has this, the last of the old heresy, loomed in the eyes of Eastern Christians. The Feast of Orthodoxy, founded to commemorate the defeat of iconoclasm, has become a feast of the triumph of the Church over all heresies. It is in this sense that that feast day is now observed. There were a few remnants left of the old iconoclast party, but it gradually dwindled away and died out. But it's from that period that we get the name iconoclast and iconoclasm. And so, friends, what do you think happened after that? Well, let's see. Probably a lot more iconoclasm occurs between cultures that are quite foreign to each other, where a religion is replaced by a succeeding religion, maybe through conquering or conversion. Let me cite an example where a Catholic broke the images of a pagan culture, like the reprehensible Aztec religion that indulged in mass human sacrifice. In Tenochtitlan, which is now Mexico City, there was an idol, a statue of an idol, at the top of a temple. It was called the Hummingbird Wizard, and peasants were sacrificed en masse and cannibalized. The steps of that temple ran with blood. They built a new temple, and they wanted to inaugurate it with a great feast day. So over the next 4 days, they sacrificed 80,000 people. Sounds impossible? There were four sides to the temple, so they had four teams, which were relieved quite frequently by other teams over a period of 4 days. Cortez was not just a conqueror, a conquistador. The Great Commission says, "Go forth and spread the gospel throughout the world." Cortez took that very seriously. He evangelized. He had a grand purpose of evangelizing. Cortez, of course, as a Catholic, was disgusted by the idea of human sacrifice. He mounted the steps of the temple. He came up face to face with the idol of the Hummingbird Wizard, looked at the idol. Wielding his great Spanish sword, Cortez slashed right and left. He smashed the idol of the Hummingbird Wizard to pieces and replaced it with a statue of the Virgin Mary. Now, I'm not going to recommend that as an effective evangelizing technique. I don't think so. However, let's describe the Aztec culture. They were an elite class, rather effete, rather highly cultured, and they ruled over millions of ordinary peasants from whom they selected their victims for the next human sacrifice. I'm sure the peasants were not necessarily unhappy that Cortez had brought an end to the cult of human sacrifice. But many people understand the importance of symbols to move the human heart one way or another. Let's face it, images need to be taken seriously. They move the human heart, sometimes bypassing rationality. They can move the human heart for good or ill. Iconoclasts realize the power of images. This is a complex issue. You certainly can have mixed feelings about it. For one thing, if the images have value as beautiful art, then art historians and lovers of art may want to preserve them just for that, even if they represent a symbol that no longer has a contemporary meaning. There's good reason to preserve them. I'm not recommending one way or another. They can offend, and they can inspire. It just depends. I sort of got the idea for this podcast from an article that appeared on the internet yesterday about the removal of some Catholic statues from a Catholic school. And in recent weeks, there's been a lot of instances of the removal or destruction of statues honoring Confederate heroes. One could feel several ways about this. It is a vast subject. Well, this is a subject that is too complex for a big, thick book, let alone a short podcast. But let me tell you about the article. The article is headlined, "Offensive Christian Statues Removed." Statue hysteria must have taken over. It's now spread to the Catholic realm. First, it was the names of schools. Then it was the founding fathers. Then came Confederate symbols and statues. But liberals at one California school have really gone crazy by removing 162 symbols and statues, including the Virgin Mary and baby Jesus. The San Domenico boarding school has removed these pieces with the attempts to be more inclusive. They claim that it has nothing to do with the recent push to get rid of Confederate statues. But we disagree. Parents and others are in an uproar. One says, in our time here, the word Catholic has been removed from the mission statements. The sacraments were removed from the curriculum. The lower school curriculum was changed to world religions. The logo and colors were changed to be less Catholic. And the uniform was changed to be less Catholic. Those observations are from an email written by a woman named Shannon Fitzpatrick to school officials. Some of her complaints were published. The school's head of trustees claims they're removing these symbols because it lessens a chance it might offend a non-Catholic. Quote, "We didn't want to further that feeling of alienation non-Catholic students might have if they encounter statues. But removing Mary and baby Jesus statue is not just a Catholic issue. Those are universal symbols of Christianity in general. They took down symbols of Christianity. Even non-Catholics are offended. Kim Pipke, whose daughter left San Domenico 2 years ago after graduating from the ninth grade, said some of the statues were also important to families who aren't Catholic. Quote, "One main statue that has everyone fired up is the baby Jesus and Mary one," Pipke said. "It was at the center of the primary school courtyard." Pipke said the school had a ceremony during which children would place a crown on the statue of Mary. "It was less about God and more about passing on some traditions," Pipke said. People were shocked that the statues were pitched into the basement. What is the goal here, people? Just another example of having political correctness forced upon us. This article is by Elizabeth True, a staff writer for the District of Columbia Statesman. Another infamous and quite destructive emergence of iconoclasm occurred to the English Protestant Reformation in the 1530s. That Reformation changed England's official religion from Roman Catholic to Anglican, and the result was the destruction of centuries of religious art. When Henry VIII wasn't able to persuade the Pope to annul his marriage to Catherine of Aragon so that he could remarry, he summoned the Reformation Parliament to enact laws requiring members of the clergy to submit to his self-imposed position as the head of the new Church of England, now Protestant, sort of a Protestant Pope, but one in which state and church were united, no separation, quite different from the Pope. King Henry VIII was bankrupt at that time, and at that time, the monasteries and the Catholics possessed one-fifth of the land area of Britain. One-fifth. Now, the monks didn't acquire all that by any illegitimate ways. Far from it. No, they took wastelands, moors, marshes, fens, and improved the land by 11 centuries of hard labor, creating the beautiful English landscape we know today. Much of it man-made, monk-made. Working the land. Improving the land. The reason the monks possessed that land is they came to it first. It wasn't widely occupied. These were the worst areas of Britain. And they made them, through 11 centuries of labor, the best. Draining swamps, filling in marshes, landscape in the beautiful English countryside. By hand, ora et labor, they worked and prayed. And they produced magnificent buildings, the abbeys, and beautiful country roads winding along the hills. So having worked it for 1,100 years, they were about to lose it, and much more besides. Lose their lives in many cases. Oh, of course, there were those who didn't lose their lives because they abandoned their faith to save their lives. But Henry VIII, being bankrupt, confiscated these monasteries and transferred all their estates as well as their silver and gold to him, to the crown. In 1540, the last of more than 500 monasteries were closed. King Henry VIII ordered the dissolution of the monasteries, sometimes called the suppression of the monasteries, but actually much better called the destruction of the monasteries, because he ordered them torn down, and they were so well built that was very difficult and expensive to do, so they simply took the roofs off. And that's why you have these lovely ruins all over England. They didn't decay over the years. They were destroyed. And as you might suspect, there was a massive outbreak of iconoclasm. Statuary was smashed. Stained glass windows were broken out. It was again iconoclasm at full tide. Now, King Henry VIII died in 1547. He was succeeded by a young man, his son Edward VI, who was a dedicated Protestant. And he decided to finish the job, the removal of all religious images from places of worship. These depictions included shrines, statues, and wall paintings. Religious zealots heeded his call and desecrated churches, destroying shrines and textiles and smashing religious sculptures. In Nottingham, there had been a Nottingham School of Alabasters, sculptors, who had been sculpting alabaster religious figures since the 14th century. Most of these were bas-reliefs depicting the crucifixion or the lives of individual saints, and they were placed on altars or set in wall niches. Usually they were colorfully painted and gilded. There happened to be a lot of alabaster quarries around Nottingham, and the school was so successful that the sculptures were sent abroad and sold for high prices. They were an early export, like Limoges enamels from France. Practically all of these works were religious works. Many of them are very fine art, but they're hard to find now. They're very rare. It's especially hard to find the Nottingham alabaster figures in Britain. If you do find one, it's been damaged. There are a few, but they're rare because they're very old. There's a woman that collects these. She's a specialist in European sculptures and works of art at Sotheby's in London. She said she gets about one a year of these alabaster figures. If she wants to get a whole one, she has to search outside of England. Another London dealer said, "I have a virgin and child, which is rare." They were the first to be destroyed in the Reformation. Now, where can you find the British Nottingham alabasters? Well, in Catholic countries. They can be found in Portugal and far away as Iceland. English medieval art had an idiosyncratic quality that's quite different from that of the art of the continent. There's something more ethereal about English art. And what a loss it's been to all of us. You know, you can study late medieval England through Shakespeare's history plays, and you'll discover a land constantly at war with France or with itself, a chaotic period of squabbling nobles, fighting and usurping kings. Yet it was also an era of prosperity with enough wealth to build fine churches and to fill them with stained glass windows, paintings, elaborate tombs, and other works of religious art. But little survives of this world, this creative world, beyond the buildings themselves, and often those are only the walls. With the Reformation, Henry VIII and his son Edward VI presided over this large-scale destruction of treasures associated with Roman Catholicism. Religious art vanished, and English moved from being a visual country to one that expressed itself in words. In my own life, when I was studying art at the University of Kentucky, I wondered, how could this nation that had such magnificent literature have done so little in sculpture and the plastic arts? I didn't understand that they had destroyed most of it, because most of it was religious. There have been some exhibits in recent decades. The Victoria and Albert Museum in London is one of them, and they set out to gather and display what survived the iconoclastic fury in Gothic art for England. The objects in that show range from 1500 to 1547, the death of Henry VIII. That show underlined the high quality of the work by the artists in the 15th century and 16th century, and to show the close artistic ties between England and continental Europe, notably Flanders, Burgundy, France, Germany, and later Italy. The shame of it is that the British had their own magnificent school of sculpture, true competitors with the art in those other countries. Actually, England's Gothic era began much earlier than 1400, by which time the great Gothic cathedrals had already been built. The decision was made at that show to end the dates bracketing that show at the death of Henry VIII in 1547. Some of the sculpture in that show seemed to some observers to be derivative of the Italian Renaissance. But they had their own style, a Gothic style that prevailed in England. There were, yes, there had been a new affluence. It spawned a conspicuous artistic consumption, I guess, evident in both the churches and the private homes. Whether this produced Gothic art as such is a moot question. Imported from France in the 13th century, Gothic architecture was enthusiastically adopted and adapted as Gothic perpendicular for English cathedrals, churches, colleges, palaces, and mansions. The style also influenced tomb effigies, stained glass windows, and illuminated manuscripts. English craftsmen were busiest carving wooden stone for parish churches and wealthy homes. Like religious stone sculptures, stained glass windows suffered during the Reformation. But one of the 28 windows from St. Mary's Fairford in Gloucester was on display in that show. It's a measure of the difficulty of organizing this exhibition that objects had to be borrowed not only from collections in the Netherlands, France, Germany, Belgium, and the United States, but also from across England, including Oxford and Cambridge colleges and museums. The enduring affection that the English had for the Gothic style became most apparent in the 19th century when the Victorian age wanted a new English style. It reinvented Gothic. Today, with its cathedral-like windows and spiky towers, the Houses of Parliament may seem to symbolize centuries of democratic rule. But no, these buildings are relatively new. They're built in the 19th century. They were built to evoke the lost world of the Catholic Gothic architecture of the 1500s and the 1400s. Well, let's finish up this subject by talking about the biblical basis for using images of every kind to aid us in our worship of God and our honoring of the saints. I'm going to cite some passages from the Bible to illustrate that God himself instructed us to create sacred images and to use them to aid us in our prayers and aid us in our worship of God. Many Protestants refer to this passage, Exodus 20, 4 and 5, and they use it to oppose the use of statues and religious images. They quote that passage to this effect, quote, that making any graven images or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in earth beneath is detestable to God. And then they stop there. But you have to read on. You have to read this passage in context to understand it. It is not the making of images that is condemned, but the worship of them. In the next five chapters in the Bible, God commands the Israelites to make two golden statues of angels as part of the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. Look it up. It's Exodus 25, verses 17 to 19. Yes, here God is commanding mankind to make religious statues, angels, images of angels. That's the image of something from heaven. Then in 1 Kings 6, God turns his attention to earthly things, that images of flowers be created, and images of palm trees, as well as a 15-foot-tall statues of cherubim. Solomon's temple was richly adorned with images of nature. It depicted the night sky, the celestial constellations, painted on its ceiling. The next example is a rather famous one, the bronze serpent. It's in Numbers 21. God commands that a bronze serpent be made, and Moses uses it to heal the Israelites. It's interesting that that bronze serpent was preserved for a long time, 800 years, but then it was destroyed when somebody began to worship it. One more iconoclastic destruction. That's in 2 Kings 18, 4. So Catholics don't really worship statues because only God is deserving of adoration. The Catechism of the Catholic Church is very clear in affirming this. When a Catholic bows to a statue, he's not worshiping it any more than King Solomon worshiped Bathsheba when he bowed to her in 1 Kings 2:19. In other words, the honor we give to images doesn't detract from the honor that is due to God only. After all, if one member of the body is honored, the others should share in its joy, 1 Corinthians 12:26. If somebody comes into your house, he's probably going to find a picture of your mother. Most of us have such a picture. So when someone walks into a Catholic church, the house of God, he shouldn't be too surprised to find a picture of the Mother of God along with the rest of the family. God inspired the Israelites to create a beautiful temple strewn with images, 1 Kings 6. God acknowledged the reason why he gave us our senses. He gave us our senses to use them to worship God in spirit and truth. We use words, which are symbols. Actually, letters are graven images. Actually, words printed on a page are graven images. That means the Bible was made up of graven images. They're symbols that have meaning. The picture of the Virgin Mary in a house of God is a symbol of his mother. The crucifix is a symbol of the great event that saved us all from original sin and opened the doors of heaven to us again. This is Chuck Coffin on Breadbox Media, talking about the new iconoclasm that's broken out, tearing down statues around the country of people of various virtues, some without too much virtue. After all, in front of Parliament in London, there's a statue of Cromwell. Oliver Cromwell, the Puritan, is hardly a person many Catholics would want to honor. But why not leave it there? It's art. It's rather well done. Would you imagine something with me? If you and I were to walk into church together, we would be two images of God in the church. Because God created us in his image. Yes, we're images ourselves. God said so. Perhaps I would watch you light a candle, and perhaps then you would kneel before a statue of the Sacred Heart. And then I would look at you and see an image that God himself had created. It's you. You're an image of God. I'm Chuck Coffin, setting the record straight about images, about honoring God with images. This is BreadboxMedia.com.